Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Starmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
We are sitting here in Central America. My name is Ulrich from MesoPartner with Martin Doherty, SPS expert from England. And we like to talk about the implication for local communities. What is the implication of SPS, the sanitary and phytosanitary requirements, especially of the European Union? And Martin, and where you're coming from and what is your professional background?
Hello, I'm Martin Doherty. I have spent 35 years in trade, both in the public sector, working for the Department of Trade in the United Kingdom, and nearly 20 years as a consultant specializing in one of the biggest trade barriers that there is now, which is the food safety standards of the European Union.
Okay, Martin, this podcast series is about local economic development, and before we talk about interesting experience of you in Kenya with local entrepreneurs to export vegetables to European Union, what was this experience about?
This is a very interesting example. In Kenya, we have a big group of entrepreneurs. These are small farmers who had a very good product in terms of fruit and vegetables, but particularly little green beans. They wanted to export to the European Union, but found that the assistance available from the government and the bureaucracy was not very good. They had to meet a standard called EuropeGAP, which is a European standard for good agricultural practice. But the cost of this for very small enterprises was very great, nearly $8,000 per small farm and $2,000 each year to renew the certificate. They formed an association for fruit and vegetables and approached the United Kingdom government for support, what we call bilateral assistance. The Department for International Development in the UK gave €200,000, and the entrepreneurs produced a local standard which was based on European legislation, which covered fruit and vegetables, and they benchmarked this to the international standard EuropeGAP. This enabled them to export much more cheaply to the European Union because they were able to introduce it for each farm for about €2,000, and its recertification each year was about €500. So it was a quarter of the cost. Kenya fruit and vegetables, or particularly vegetables, are now a niche, high-profile product on all European supermarket shelves. And it's a result of the entrepreneurs adopting a self-help program and knowing where to go and look for information, knowing where to go and look for assistance, but more importantly, deciding to help themselves and not wait for a government to try and cut through the bureaucracy which was stopping them exporting. It's a very useful example for the very many small farmers and producers here in Central America.
Interesting, the experience sounds like the Kenyan producers had clear target to go to European market. Who was the driver of this initiative? Was this people of the farmer sector in Kenya? Was it the DFID people who helped them to establish the association? Or was there a supermarket or retailer chain behind driving them to join their supply chain?
Well, this was an initiative of the local farmers in Kenya who banded together into an association. They sought help from the European Union initially, and they looked at one of the European Union aid programs called COLI ACP. This is a body set up to help the African, Caribbean and Pacific nations export to the European Union. COLI ACP itself advised them to look for financial assistance from bilateral donors, and they suggested the UK differed. Once the money came through, it was COLI ACP officials helped the officials in Kenya itself, the farmers, to actually write and structure the code of practice.
I'm still asking me how they found the clients in Europe. What was the process? Was there a previous experience to export to Europe, or did they first thought about we have to fulfill the requirement of this Europe now global gap standard and then go for it? What was the sequence of activities step by step to reach the European market?
There's always been a demand from the European Union for fruit and vegetable products, because the European Union does not grow exotic fruit and vegetables, pineapples and various things like this. But what Kenya was exporting was products which the European Union does produce. Small Kenya beans, for example, mushrooms and various other things which were in competition. But they decided they would have a superior product. The demand came from the existence of the big supermarket chains, who are always looking at developing countries as supply bases. For Kenya, this wasn't difficult because Kenya was very closely related to the United Kingdom as an ex-colony. But the supermarket chains and the retail chains are always looking out for new products. What they only want is supply bases who have certified, accredited, safe products. So once Kenya had established the Kenya gap, benchmark to Europe gap, the barrier had actually gone. There was no problem with potential customers. There is no problem with potential customers from the European Union. The problem comes in having a product which you can sell, and that is based on two things. One, the quality, which Ulrich was just talking about, but secondly, meeting the standards of the European Union on sanitary and phytosanitary conditions, which producing a standard benchmark to an international one will remove. Exporting then becomes much simpler. The matter is only comes of putting the money in the bank.
It sounds like a success story, and it sounds really easy. Only you have to associate our local farmers in a developing country, getting in with select one of the standards, like in this case Global Gap, and find the client in the European Union and export. Where do you see actually for local producers in Kenya, but also in other developing countries, the main obstacles to go this sequencing, reaching a very developed market like in the European Union?
The main obstacles now originate from the fact that the retail chains are consolidating. They're getting bigger and bigger, and they really are only interested in dealing in volumes, large amounts, because they feed into big supermarkets. They require consistency. They require these volumes which they can rely on throughout the year. They are not particularly interested in dealing directly with small farmers for small lots. The problem comes then that the small farmers have got to be organized under an umbrella organization, such as a collective, who puts the small lots together into a commercially attractive lot. We then begin to have a problem with some of the SPS regulations which require traceability. In case there is a problem in the European Union where you have a contaminated product which is injuring people, it is necessary to know where that product originated. So you need to have a system called traceability whereby you can decide, find out where your mango, your beans, your cattle or whatever the product is, actually originated, and be able to quarantine that particular area. If you don't have a traceability system, the European Union has to ban all products either from the country or, at the worst case, ban all products from the country itself. But a traceability system can be very expensive when you get down to the very small farmer layer. So traceability is one of the biggest problems which you have to overcome to be able to supply the big import chains. But if firms are doing it, associations are doing it, it is not impossible.
You talked about traceability and especially the cost of traceability. The additional cost in a value chain when you like to come out now with your products to European community, it's probably a must to have a traceability system to go in. Who takes the cost of these systems, and what is the possibility for small farmers to afford this kind of systems?
This is the most important point. It will vary from size of firm to size of firm and product to product. But as a very rough example, an organization bringing together perhaps 200, 300, 400 small farms together in Africa and some parts of Asia, the profit level is about 12% on what they sell into the import chain. The traceability element of that, though, cost, which the collective meets on behalf of the small farmer, is about 50%. In other words, 6% of the organization collecting the bulk products goes in meeting the traceability requirement. If the price is passed on to the small farmer, they make no profit at all, because they generally only make about 6% of what is generated through the value chain. So traceability rests with the first step up in the collective. If they are in fact very closely associated with a supermarket chain, it is possible that the price or the cost is transmitted through the value chain. But where you have very competitive products, the supermarket chain says, no, it will rest with the collective. If you want to do business with us, you will take the cost. This is a very real problem, and in some ways makes the development of very small farmers in the future more difficult than it has been for many years. The push, therefore, is the development of larger groupings of farms and business enterprises which eventually become single enterprises and operate as single units. The movement is away from multi-product farming units into mono development, single products under a single collective umbrella. So you will have three or four farms which will develop green beans, three or four farms which will develop another item of fruit or vegetable. And the idea is that the collective profit is given back to the farmers and shared out. So the costs of meeting SPS standards such as pesticides, fertilizers, fungicides, etc., is equally shared out, and the collective grows together at a pace.
Yes, when you're talking about products you export to European retailers or supermarkets, you said the argument of scale. You need to have the critical mass, you need to have also constant delivering. On the other hand, we have now a higher demand not only on commodities, more on specialties. Here we are sitting in Honduras, a coffee producing country. Now they are demanding not only the coffee traded in the coffee places like New York and London. Now they trade also specialty coffees, gourmet coffee, bird-friendly coffee, local domination of origin, all these kind of specialty coffees. where you can get add-on like a local producer on your product price. This could be a strategy for local producers to differentiate also their products, and how can be handled this within this kind of global value chain?
I think this is a very good point. What we're looking at here is how to overcome a problem if you don't have the basic big volume to supply, or if local conditions mean that there aren't enough small farmers which can be gathered into a collective, or even the environment, the local bureaucracy doesn't allow you to do it. Here you look for what we call market differentiation products, new products, specialty products, niche products. And here the value chain or the chain may not always be the big retail chains. There are also smaller chains who specialize in areas which have things like organic products, novel foods, which is the development of new, generally fruit and vegetable, where you have a hybrid, a new hybrid, a cross between a plum and a tomato, or a new development of orange, where they bring together oranges and tangerines and they produce a new fruit. Now, this sells at about 2-3 times the normal price in Europe. And we have particular health food chains, we have new product chains, we have specialty areas of supermarkets. Now, these do not require the same volume of products, because where as a person I might buy a net of oranges 2 or 3 times a week, I will only buy a new product, a new piece of fruit, to try to see what it's like. And I might only buy it once or twice a month. But it's still high value, high profitability. So the idea is, if you don't have the volume, you develop the high value, specialty, novel approach. You also look for the possibility of profit from byproduct production. For example, we have seen that in the fish sector, in aquaculture, the development of tilapia, that people are now finding an outlet for skins, fish skins, tilapia skins. And I've had an example recently where I think it's in Thailand, they're exporting bikinis which are made out of tilapia fish skin. And there's a range of similar types of byproducts which I personally would never have imagined. But if an entrepreneur is seriously about making a profit in Europe, if he thinks of a new product and a new application, there will be consumers, because the European Union is now the largest market in the world. There's 470 million people, all with high incomes, all looking for something new, all looking for a change from the ordinary. So a new product will find a new outlet. And because the import chains are organized, you will find a fairly easy market entry. It's the question of identifying who you are. Are you a volume producer? Are you a high-value niche producer? Are you going to invest your money in marketing? Are you investing your money in research and development? Do you have the imagination to look at what you're throwing away and thinking, I could use that for something completely different? Because this is what other entrepreneurs throughout the world are actually doing.
Yes, when I understand you right, the beginning of the process is first to think about what our particular competitive advantage in our local community, in our local group of producers, what we can do good Are you good in volume, or are we good in a specialty niche like indigenous products, for example, like organic products? We have behind a certain history of our community, of our surrounding, we can sell. Because many times it's not only the product you sell, it's more the packing and the story around the product or what you're selling and how to innovate. My experience is that many times in developing countries, the producers are used in a certain way to produce. And for them, it's very difficult to know about what the European people are now thinking about, why they are now worried about organic food, why they are worried about this case of animal welfare, why they like to dress in a tilapia bikini. How the people in developing countries can get a clue about what people in developed countries require, where are the new trends, where are how to innovate in developing countries for a market, what is out there very far, far away from their local reality.
This is one of the problems, because the market is constantly changing. There are two ways. You either attend international trade fairs in Europe, which can be expensive for small developing countries, but there is an increasing trend towards international regional trade fairs, which bring together new products, innovation. And one of the best ways of finding where these are is to look on the internet. There's an awful lot of information both about European regulations but also about trade fairs and specialized trade fairs. And a few years ago, the trend in trade fairs was for the general trade fair, where you had machinery, you had services, you had everything. Now you are getting much smaller trade fairs, trade exhibitions, quite often held in a hotel environment, where you will get maybe 40 or 50 exhibitors in a particular product area. And they themselves have taken away some of the problem in that they are targeting that region, and they want people to come forward and say, we have this product. They themselves, the exhibitors, often have the research and development knowledge and enter into joint ventures with the individual companies. The second way of doing it is to find companies in Europe who want to enter into a joint venture and have the knowledge of the market. They have the research and development skills, but the main thing is they have the entree. They can open the doors in the market. They already have contracts with small specialist chains, some of the big chains, but they know what to do with the product. The problem is, how do you get in touch with these? Now, there are several different schemes around. The one I like particularly is run by the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, UNIDO, and they run a scheme called piggybacking. And there, if you contact each country in Europe has a UNIDO office, and if you contact that, they're also, you could source them on the web. They have a list of all firms in Europe who have expressed interest in cooperation with developing countries by different product areas. Their job is to put you as a developing firm in contact with a firm that has expressed specific interest in a joint venture. They don't fund anything other than the meeting of the European company and the developing enterprise. They will fund the country, the European firm, flying out and having opening discussions. And from there, it's a normal commercial enterprise. But the first, most important bit is the bringing together of two people who have a similar idea and enabling them to actually activate a common purpose. So UNIDO is one good route to go through.
As you said, there are a lot of facilities to get contact with target markets. You mentioned the trade fairs, and you might mention this activities to get in touch with the buyers of the big chains, or get in touch also with more specialized little firms or organizations who are in organic and on and the trade fairs. There are a lot of standards out there, different. We talked about this global gap, but we have also this fair trade standards, we have this organic standards. How do you see the tendency of this standards? Have local producers look a lot to these standards and to choose between, or do they preferably have to select first some kind of buyers and then the standard is coming with a buyer and they have not to think a lot about this kind of standards?
It's interesting. A lot depends on where you've decided you're going to export. If you're in Central America and you say you're just going to export to the United States, you're primarily just looking at United States standards. But if you want to diversify and relax the dependency on the American market, you might decide to go to Japan, or you might decide to go to Australia. But then you might decide, I'll go to Japan and the European Union. You want a standard then, that you don't want to develop a standard for Japan and a standard for Europe. You want a standard that is recognized in both. Global Gap has now achieved the point of being recognized in Japan and naturally Europe has come from. But individual countries have started saying, right, we will adopt Global Gap, but we will develop our own standards. You have China Gap, you have Thai Gap, in Africa you have Kenya Gap. Around the world we have country, good agricultural practice. So you decide where is you're going. You choose a big standard, and you either develop whatever is your own country standard, or you adopt the international standard that is recognized in the markets you want to export to. Life is getting easier with the big standards like Global Gap who have got international recognition. There are several others also under the global initiative. There are American standards who are also linked and benchmarked to the equivalent of Europe Gap. So some of it depends on your product, some of it depends on your market, but life is getting easier now. You can decide where you want to export. The answer comes to finding your chain, your import chain. They will tell you what it is they accept, but you'll probably know already before. It's widely known.
When I understand you right, it's in this world now not only about requirements of the nation, of the region where you like to export, it's more about this kind of private standards like this expanding standard, for example, Europe Gap, Global Gap, to come into the market of European Union. Then local producers do not have only to look after the requirements of the official requirements of the states, they also have to look what are the special requirements of clients or groups of clients, am I right?
This is where it becomes very interesting, in that all standards are not the same. Global Gap's requirements are different to the requirements, say, of American SQS. And there's SQS quality systems. I think there's a range of 1, 2, 3, and 4. The range of competing standards all have at their core the same elements. They will require being a food processing establishment, a hazard analysis critical control point system, traceability, meeting with ISO standards. But the difference comes where they go beyond that. And for example, Europe Gap begins to look for environmentally sound practices, social practices. They say that your process should not pollute rivers, should not pollute the air. They say that if you're on a farm, you should not be employing, you know, women at slave wages. You should not be employing children under the age of 12, because they say they should be at school. So a range of new issues are being tacked into these standards. Climate change is now being added to some of them. They say energy saving. You should not be burning fossil fuels. You should be in a country where solar energy is available. You should have panels on your factory, etc., to provide your life. You should have potable water for things like agriculture, but not just for the production of fish. If you do that, you should also provide infrastructural help to the people living around, so they have clean water through wells, etc. So these standards are not just related to trade, they're related to the economic development of countries themselves. So the standards are seen not just as tools to develop trade, they're seen as economic development instruments in their own, which is why many people say that the private sector codes of practice and standards are now as powerful, if not more powerful, than individual national governments' requirements, either of SPS or development programs.
Yes, Marvin, this is quite important to this new requirement of private standards. To wrap up this interview, for me, it would be interesting that you give us some practical resource where people in developing countries, from local association of producers or local communities who like to export to European Union, have to look where they can find proper information to reach to this European market.
Now, this is quite a simple one. There is absolutely no lack of information. The problem is sorting through the information. With technology as it is, the internet is the first site. The European Commission has got a whole range of sites. It's divided into two areas. One is pure information as to what legislation is and what the requirements are. And you also have the help desks which have been established, which are more commercially oriented. The help desks are run by the European Commission and tend to have a European Commission view of life, and they may not always reflect the realities of life, but they do give information of what other countries, what developing countries' problems are being faced, and the solutions which are being made available by the European Commission. This gives you an idea of where assistance is coming from. Alongside that, you have a range of assistance programs, both run by the European Commission and donor agencies. You have programs designed just to help the African, Caribbean, Pacific countries, ACP. You have programs designed to help the developing countries worldwide meet specific pieces of legislation, like introduction of national food control systems, which means that the governments have to have a very effective inspection services, accreditation systems, etc. And there's capacity building assistance available there. Some of the capacity building assistance can be available in the private sector, where the private sector is taking on the role that the public sector can't afford to do. The public sector says that laboratories will be in the private sector acting on our behalf. Some of this capacity building may be available, that is, purchase of equipment as well as training in the private sector. And these programs, such as the Fish Support Program, are clearly on the web also. There is a range of individual national donor programs which are also available, and you look on the country websites for that. For UK, you identify the ministry which looks after development. Each country has a different name. in the United Kingdom, where I come from, which is why I quote it, the Department for International Development, DFID, we call it, DFID. And that has a very large website, because the United Kingdom has got worldwide connections for trade for historic reasons. It also has a very widespread network of commercial organizations who probably reflect the greatest concept of helping import-export. Probably the United States is the next one. But the United Kingdom has a history of ex-colonial contacts and empire building. And this network of commerce and mixed with politics is still here. So the commercial department of the British Embassy is very active. And there is a system called the Export Intelligence Service in the United Kingdom. If you have an inquiry and you're looking for a joint venture, you're looking for assistance, looking for representation, or whatever it is, they will transmit that inquiry to the United Kingdom, and it will be published through a computerized service called the Export Intelligence Service. And that has approximately 15,000 companies who subscribe to that, and something within about 48 hours, your inquiry would have been sent to all of those. So this is not an advert for the United Kingdom, but it is a very good source of information.
Yes, thank you, Martin. I think for us it's interesting that there is a possibility to export to European Union, but not in the traditional old-fashioned way. You need to look to your competitive advantage. You look to have a focus. You look to understand your target market, what is changing all the time. And when you like to come in, have an LEA, you need to reach all the standards or a special standard set by the private sector to get into this market. And for doing all this, there's a lot of help out there. There are a lot of agencies, information sources to help local producers to do that. Well, thank you, Martin, for this interview. I hope it's very helpful for local producers to get nearer to this sometimes very technical topic of SPS and make it more vivid and near to their local needs and local reality. Thank you very much.